You should add, if you had your knitting, now that's going fast for me because I got all that filing done, see? If you have something to do. But you know, each time I pick up a fact that I overlooked before. Sure. We were supposed to have erased and then...
Old Addle at his home in Wild Rose on May 14th, 1979. You work for the railroad, and I want to ask you some of the questions about your work and about the history of the railroad. When did the railroad come through Wild Rose?
The railroad came to Wild Rose in 1901, in August, I believe. And their surveying started in 1900.
How was the railroad taken care of?
Well, it was taken care of by the section men, the tracks were, and then the trainmen took care of the trains.
What people do you remember early, some of the early workers?
Well, I don't remember it, but August Zick was the first section foreman here. That's Lila Zick's father, but that was before my day. But the first section foreman I can remember was Clint Hujuk. That's Ray Hujuk's father.
Where were the tracks and how have they changed?
Well, there was used to be three tracks down the yard here, and they took one of them out in 1943, and then they also took out the Y. That's where the trains turned around. The Y was right north of where Arnold Roberts lives.
Why was the Y located in Wild Rose?
It was about the halfway point between Farnelac and Marshfield.
The coal chutes were also here and the water tower. What can you tell us about the coal chute and the water tower?
Well, when they had four passengers and four freights a day here, they used to have three men taking different shifts working in the coal shed. What do you want me to say?
Well, how did they get the coal into the engine of the train?
Well, they pushed the cars of coal up into the shed and then they shoveled it out and then they had chutes. And then when the train, the engine came, they lowered the chute and the coal ran out into the tender of the engine.
And the water, can you explain a little bit more about how the water was got into the water tank?
Well, they had kind of like a chute there, a round pipe-like, and they just pulled that down, and they pulled a valve, and the water went into the tender of the engine till it was full, and then they shut it off and raised the pipe.
And how about the man that worked getting the water up into the tower?
Well, he rode the trains from one place to another, like from Ripon was the first one, and then Princeton, and Bannerman, Wild Rose, Bancroft, and Wisconsin Rapids, which were the water towers were located. But there was only one coal chute, and that was at Wild Rose. That was about 60 miles from Farnelac and about 60 miles from Marshfield.
How did the man have time to get the water into the tower?
Well, he came and he waited till the next train, and there was a gasoline engine that pumped the water into the train, or into the water tower.
You said there were four passenger trains a day. What time of the day did they run?
Well, the morning train came down about 6:30 in the morning, and then the one that was from the north, and the one from the south came back about 12:30, and they met in Elmond, and I'd see about 1:30, the one came from the north again, and then at about 9:30 at night, the last one came through, and they carried mail, and they had a mail car on, and a baggage car, and two or three passenger cars.
You also said something interesting about the Wautoma Fair. What was it?
Well, that was the biggest day of the year, to my way of thinking. They only had 3 days in, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and it was either the last of September or first of October. And they closed the school ground because nobody would go to school on Thursday because that was the big day.
And you took the train down at 6:30 and came back at 9:30 at night.
Yes.
How many, what people were on the train to take care of the train?
There was a engineer, fireman, brakeman, and of course they had a man that sorted the mail in the mail car, and then the conductor.
And if you sent a letter from Wild Rose, it would be sorted by the time it got to Wautoma and would be left there?
Yes. Yes, it would.
How did they heat the cars at that time?
Well, when I can remember, they were hit with steam from the engine.
When did the last passenger train go through Wild Rose?
April 5th, 1954. But then there was only two passenger trains a day then. There was one up and one back.
When did they start using diesel engines?
I would say about 1953.
What villages or cities were on this section of the railroad that ran from Fond du Lac to Marshfield?
First was El Dorado, next was Rosendale, and then Ripon, I would say was a city, and then Green Lake, Princeton, Nashcora, and then they stopped at Bannerman because the trains came out of Red Granite to meet the passenger trains, and also the freights. And then there was Wautoma, Wild Rose, Elmond, Kellner, Wisconsin Rapids, and Vesper. Another one then, I can't think of it now. Well, that's, and then Marshfield. There's another one then, I can't think of it now.
That's all right. What buildings were along the railroad?
Well, the warehouse was starting at the co-op up there. I can't tell you who run it at first, but then there was Melcher. He owned the lumber yard also. And then there was Leonard Gossett and Riley, and somebody by the name of Jim Gunderson ran that. And then the next one was Jim Kelly. And then the next one was Wesley Hart, that's Melva Hart's adopted father. And then the next one was Lewis Jinks, that burnt down. And then there was one down there, we call it in the hole, across from the Pickle Company. And of course the Pickle Company was there.
How are the potatoes shipped out?
Well, when it was cold weather, there was a man went with them, and he had wood in it, and he would take care of about four cars. Now, if they didn't stop, he'd fire up here at Wild Rose, and then when he got to Fond du Lac in the yard, then he'd have to fire them again.
How was the material gotten from the railroad to downtown in Wild Rose?
They had a drayman. He met, well, most of the trains, but at night, of course, he didn't. The first one I can remember was somebody by the name of Spurgeon, but they moved away. But Chet Hansel was Draymond for a long time, and then in later years, Ross Cage was.
What were some of the things that were shipped out or brought in, either one?
Well, exactly everything was shipped in. Well, it had to be all shipped in because that's the only way they could get it. And then they shipped rye out and the potatoes, of course. And then they had a fish house here, and there was a few carloads of fish they shipped out from the fish hatchery every year.
How about the carload of flour that you mentioned?
Well, they would ship in a carload of flour, and the merchants would divide it up between them.
There also was a stockyard located. Where was that?
That's right across from Danny Jinks's house, right west of it. There was a stockyard there, and they, I think they bought every 2 weeks on a Tuesday, and then they shipped them out Wednesday morning, and sometimes they'd have 2-3 cars to ship out at a time.
Now I'd like to ask you something about when you were working on the section. When did you start working on the railroad?
I started August the 22nd, 1943, and I retired June the 30th, 1970.
Who were some of the people that worked with you?
There's a man by the name of Gid Washburn. Leonard Hanneman was foreman, and Griff Sage, and I worked with Gid Washburn for 3 weeks, and then he had a heart attack and he died. And then Paul Moore, he worked for a while, and then afterwards John Stanky did, and then Kyle Christie.
How many miles did you take care of?
Well, when I worked for Leonard Hanneman, it was 11. They started out with 8 miles, and then they cut out some of the sections. But when I quit, I had 44 miles that I had to take care of.
What were some of the jobs you had to do in taking care of the railroad tracks?
Well, we had to see that it wasn't too rough, and also put in ties, and if there was a broken rail or anything like that. And then we used to burn the right-of-way, but then when they got so you had to have a permit, why, you couldn't do it because maybe the wind would blow and you couldn't do it. And so they cut that out.
What were the switch lights?
When I first started, we had lamps in the switch lights, and we had to fill them and light them once a week. But then later on, they got just reflectors, which saved a lot of work for us.
What can you tell about keeping the tracks straight or lining them up correctly?
Well, after we worked on the track, then we had to line it so it was not out of line. Otherwise, the train would jump from one side to the other. And the gauge on the railroad between the rails was 56 and a half inches. And when they went around the curve, there was an elevation from 1 to 3 inches, so that, you know, the train wouldn't run off the track.
What was the first thing you did in the morning?
First thing in the morning, when they had depot agents here, we used to get a lineup. That was to tell us where the trains were. But in later years, when the agent was gone, we used to call Farmlac by telephone, so we knew where the trains were.
Was there any advantage in having the telegraph over the telephone?
Well, it was better then, but in later years, why, it was better by telephone.
What other warning signals or signs did you have?
A Like if we had a broken rail or something and the train was already out, well, we put torpedoes, we called them guns, on the track, and then we'd send one man up the track and he'd signal the train down so it would stop, so it wouldn't run over the broken rail.
And if you didn't have a torpedo, what could you do?
I just run up the track and take anything you had, a flag or your cap or a newspaper, and you swung it down towards the track, waved it back and forth, and the engineer knew that was a sign that he was supposed to stop.
A couple of times there were washouts. Can you tell about that?
There was one up by Marvin Jones's there in 1918, I believe. And, Burrick was his last name. I can't think of his first name. But he stopped the train, the passenger train, and I believe they gave him a $500 because that was cheap. If the passenger train had been in there, it would have been a whole lot more than that. And he asked for steady employment on the railroad, and I believe he got it. And then afterwards, it worked out there again. And I was foreman here then, and that was in 1956, in the same place.
What special privileges did you get while you were working on the railroad?
I got passes, and then in later years, I had an annual that my wife and my children, of course the boys were gone, but my daughter, we could ride anywhere on the Northwestern by just showing this pass. But if we wanted to go on a foreign road, we had to get a trip pass, and that took about 3 weeks to get.
What buildings sat on the right-of-way, and what was done with them?
I'll start with the one that Myrtle Pether lived in, set right, Donald now, set right where the depot stands. And Henry Jeffers lived in it, and he said when they surveyed, they put one of the great stakes in the cellar. And the house that we live in set on the right-of-way, right west of what used to be Bill Bourne's house. That's just a little bit northeast of Arnold Roberts, just north of the crossing there. And then the one that Russ Patterson lived in, that was Emmett Humphrey's father, and that set right across from the Arnold Roberts's, and that was also moved. Those three buildings are the only ones that I know of that is moved.
The railroad tracks were changed from the west side to the east side. Why was this done?
That was changed in 1943, just before I got on the railroad. And they run on the west side of the depot all those years. But every time you had a new official, they had to do something to make believe they were doing something. So they changed the tracks from the west side of the depot to the east side of the depot.
You mentioned the dray that met the train. Did the dray meet the freight trains only?
Yes. They had, we called it a jitney or a cab that took the mail and met the trains, all of them. And they would haul passengers from the depot. Probably they were salesmen and it would haul other people. But they met all the trains to bring the mail to and from the post office.
Can you describe this vehicle?
Well, it was enclosed, the back end, and the front end was open. It was hauled by horses, and I'd say it would hold about 6, 8, or 10 people. They sat on each side of it, and it had windows in it, so it was enclosed. It wasn't cold in there. The wind wouldn't get at you.
How did the mail get to the train?
By this jitney. But in later years, it stopped, and the first one I can remember or recall is Ollie Hansel. He hauled it for a long time, and then N.K. Nelson hauled it.
Where was the first post office that you remember?
The first post office that I can remember was Frank Clark had it. That's Clark Davis's grandfather. And it was in the front end of the building there where Ray Hujuk's laundromat is now. And then in 1913, he was a Republican, and then they changed, Woodrow Wilson got it, and he was a Democrat, and Fay Patterson got it. And Fay Patterson had it till about 1921, and then Harding was president, and Charlie Smart had it till he passed away. And then I believe the next one was Charlie Sage and Tommy Wiroa, and then there was others like Morgan Potter and Everett Jones and Rob Williams and them, but I can't tell you how they came in order. I can't remember that.
There was a derailment in 1958. You were working at this time. Will you tell us about the derailment?
This was at Sand Crossing just north of the depot here in Wild Rose. And there was five cars derailed, and they tipped over, but the locomotive did not tip over. And they brought a crane from Green Bay with a crew, and this crane would lift 250 tons. It was operated by steam, and they put the cars back on the track. And this derailment was caused by a broken rail.
What happened to the depot?
The depot burnt in 1977. We were not here. We were in the south. And I can't tell you the exact date, but it is in the wintertime.
Now you know something about my house, and I'd like to have you tell.
Well, there used to be a lumber yard here, Kellogg Brothers Lumber Company, right where Janny Jinks' house stands. And in the corner, the northwest corner there, next to the street, there was a small building. They called it the office building. And they hauled it up with Andrew Etheridge's steam engine. That is Dewey Etheridge's father. And it's part of Mrs. Culligan's kitchen now.
Well, I want to thank you very much for the interview. It includes many of the interesting things that we wouldn't know otherwise. There's one thing you wanted to correct, though. Do you want to do that now?
I said that the warehouse burned down when Louis Jakes was, but that's not true. Louis Prether run that warehouse when I first remember, and Benny Stewart was running that warehouse when it burned down.
This recording was completed May 18, 1979. Ellen Corrigan interviewing Harold Addo at Wild Rose.
All right, now let's pray that this one's got something on it.
Okay, have you got?
I haven't touched it yet. It's
okay.
It's going yet.
What's going? Okay.
What's
Nine. Ellen Corrigan interviewing Harold Addo at Wild Rose.
Good. Now let's see what we got.
Yeah.